This is the No Dogma Podcast. I'm Brian Hogan, and today I'm joined by Tomasz Petrycek, researcher at the Alan Turing Institute in London, author and Pluralsight author. Thank you very much for taking time out of your Sunday to talk to me, Tomasz.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
So to start, can you tell me a little bit about yourself, please?
This could be very long, but the most interesting parts are I've been doing quite a lot of work around the F# programming language and functional programming. I'm also partly academic, so I've done some research around types in programming languages, and I think the sort of technical aspects of that work partly led me to interest in history and philosophy of programming. So how it's been done in the past, and why are we doing things the way we are doing them. And the most recent thing is I've been working on tools for data science. So this is the Alan Turing Institute position, where this is a fairly new institute in London doing data science. And I'm there spending a year and a half, roughly, working on making data science easier.
And you've written a book, is it with John Skeet?
That's correct, yeah. That's been some time ago, but I've written a book called Real World Functional Programming with John Skeet, which was sort of, so my background back then was, I was a C# developer and I got curious about F# and started learning it. And I think when people introduce F#, they will often tell you, well, this is functional programming. You have to forget everything you know about programming and start afresh, and then you'll be enlightened. And the idea with the book is that really it's not the case. There's a lot of things that C# developers know already, and we just have to explain things differently. So the book tries to explain the sort of functional style in F# by actually using C# examples, and that's where John Skeet came in as well.
I have two podcasts recorded, unreleased yet, with Mark Seaman. So by the time this one is released, they may well be out. And he also referred to your book as a great way of moving from C# to F#.
Yeah, I think he was one of the early, he was one of the reviewers for the book. So he's probably responsible for removing a lot of errors from it.
Yeah, one of the interesting things, I've interviewed him twice now. So I interviewed him, I think it was the summer of 2016, and he was saying he's an independent consultant. He earns his money from C#, but he loves F#. I interviewed him again the first interview was 2016, and I interviewed him a year later, 2017, and he says, now I'm an independent consultant in F#, but I love Haskell. So he's moving
well,
that direction.
I'm curious what will happen in the next interview.
So let's get back to you for a moment. What is your role at the Alan Turing? What is the Alan Turing Institute, and what do you do there?
So whenever I say Alan Turing Institute, everyone's very impressed because of Alan Turing, but the institution is around for year and a half, or maybe sort of 2 years, and it's a. I think the UK government at some point realized that data science is important, so they told a couple of universities, "Oh, you should put together money and do a data science institute." So this is an organization that sort of collaborates with a couple of big UK universities, and it got some other money from the government as well. And it's pretty much a research institute trying to advance the data science discipline, as research institutes always do. But it does have also quite interesting sort of idea of collaborating with the industry and solving really practical problems. Or when they do some research, they want to publish it as something that people can use. And I'm there. The official title is visiting researcher, because I've got the project I'm working on got funding from somewhere else. So I'm sort of sitting there working on the project with lots of other interesting researchers around, and some people doing applied data science work.
And where are you visiting from?
Well, that's the right question. But I'm actually not visiting from anywhere. Okay. So it's just that the money is visiting, and I'll have to thank to the Google Digital News Initiative for this, because they were kind enough to give me money for a year for this project. But I'm not really visiting from anywhere. But if I wanted to just stay at home, I can say, well, the place where I'm visiting from asks me to stay there. So It's quite a nice arrangement.
So for the rest of this podcast, we're going to talk about the history of errors and correctness and things like that in software. But before we get to that, we're going to just briefly discuss software as an engineering discipline. So can you walk us through the history of that?
Yeah, so I think that the topic really sort of came out of what I was doing in my PhD, where I did some fairly technical work on programming languages, and I got really interested in sort of where do all these ideas come from, and why we still can't, 50 years later, why we still can't write correct software, why we still write bugs. And so if you read something about the history, and we can recommend some nice books later on put share a link, then.
So just to let our listeners know, if they're hearing some banging in the background, it's Guy Fawkes Day in London and there's fireworks.
That's right. And now there's pretty big ones. So back to the history. If you actually get curious about the history and read something, then I find it really interesting that pretty much the same things that we are saying about software these days, people were saying in the 60s. And the really one sort of important moment for software as an engineering practice is that there was this was back in the 60s, sort of towards the end of 60s, where people thought, well, when you want to do software development, you have to hire these programmers, and they're all incredibly expensive, and nobody knows how do you even train the good ones, or how do you know which ones are good, which ones aren't good? So there was this sort of trend in the industry where everyone, all the managers, were really depressed about the state of the art, and it evolved into a NATO-organized conference on software engineering, which is where, and this was 1968, I think, which is where the software engineering phrase actually appeared. The conference, I think it was, the conference was really popular and everyone came there because everyone felt that this was the problem. But very little surprisingly came out of it, because nobody really had a good solution to the problem.
I remember I spoke with another gentleman, Lawrence Bosavie, in another podcast, and he talked about this NATO conference as well. And he said that maybe within a year or a year and a half, universities had adopted the term software engineering and started offering degrees in it. Does that sound right?
That sounds very plausible. I don't know, but I would definitely believe this, because I think this the fun thing is that back then, education was one of the sort of, well, and still is, like, how do you train good programmers? And some of the stories from the time are really hilarious, because people generally believed that whether you're going to be a good programmer or not, that's you're born, and either you are or you are not, and they just have to find out. But they didn't really have any good ways of finding out. So they came up with these tests or questionnaires that they just distributed to everyone across the whole company. And whoever was good at solving math puzzles went into programming, and they trained and became programmers. And this was also sort of one of the periods of our history where there was equal number of men and women in computing, because men and women were equally good at solving these random tests.
That's kind of, that's one of those ones that I haven't heard about in a while, this kind of idea of software as art, or programming as an art. You know, you're born with it. I don't subscribe to it at all. I think it's just pure nonsense. I mean, I've I've worked in many companies, big and small. I didn't find any artists. I didn't find any desire for artists. You know, it's not what a company wants or needs necessarily.
Yeah, well, I think for just sort of solving day-to-day engineering issues, you probably don't need to be an artist. The software as an art, I think there were sort of fairly early on, again, people tried to see if whether people are good programmers, whether they could correlate it with something, and they really couldn't. So it was like, well, maybe if you're a good chess player or you're a good mathematician or you're a good piano player, then maybe you would be a good programmer. But
was this approach taken in other disciplines, you know, traditional building engineering, traditional architecture, science, chemistry, or was this particular to software for some reason?
No, I think this was software trying to figure out what it really is. And I suppose other disciplines have their sort of interesting histories and evolutions. Design, in a way, design as in like real design, has, I think, similar sort of evolution in the 60s, where it tried to came up with like a proper method for doing things. That maybe is a common theme, because both software wanted to get away from this. It's black magic. You either do it right or you don't, but we can't control it. And design also tried to get away from, well, you just make some things, and then if it's good, it's good. If it's not, well, then try again.
We're going to talk a little bit now about the history of errors, and that's something that you've been studying for a while. Errors in software, let's say.
Yeah. The reason why I got interested in this was because I was going to a fair number of software conferences. One of them featured quite a lot of talks from people doing F-sharp, Haskell, and Erlang, and C-sharp. So it was quite a diverse mix. And when you talk about errors with people doing Erlang, they'll say completely different things than what, say, a Haskell people will tell you. So that's how I got interested in the history and sort of figuring out where these different approaches actually come from.
What would be an example? Because they're both functional languages, I think. Is that right?
Yeah. So both Erlang and Haskell are functional, but in Haskell, you try to sort of, when you run your program, you really try to have all the errors sorted out and checked using your fancy type system. And in Erlang, you just say, well, some errors will inevitably happen because we're doing sort of large-scale distributed telecommunication software. And at that scale, even a cosmic ray can flip your bit and it's just going to crash. So Erlang comes with this idea, let it crash and then have a supervision system that will monitor your software and restart parts.
But Erlang came from Ericsson, the telecommunications company, so they would expect errors.
Yeah. I think Erlang came up with this just because their sort of initial domain was telecommunications, where you just can't trust things to work. And this is probably a good sort of motivation for dealing with errors, because if your hardware, I think people in software will always say, well, hardware just works, and if you're in an environment where the hardware is just faulty because it's distributed, cheap, and so on, then you have to deal with errors differently.
So are you saying that there was a time that people felt that there should be an expectation of no errors in software? Because that's not the case now.
Yeah. No, I think there was a time, and I can't give a specific date, but if you look back in like late 50s when people really started doing first computers, digital computers, the interesting thing is they had sort of a lot of hardware faults with their vacuum tubes exploding and breaking, and equal amount of, and people, well, so people genuinely thought that the difficult part is the hardware, and the other difficult part is coming up with the mathematical sort of formulas that you then encode, and programming was going to be easy, and it's just you take the mathematical description given by a programmer, and programmer back then was the sort of mathematician. You type it into the computer, and this is trivial. Anyone can do it, and sort of people thought once they fix the hardware or make the hardware correct, it will be sorted. But it turned out that we actually managed to make the hardware pretty reliable in most cases, but software we still can't.
Is that fair though? Because we see the likes of Intel coming out with processors with bugs. We know firmware has problems, and without the firmware, your network card just won't work. We see, you know, and this is slightly on a border, but we've just realized that WPA2 is broken. So all Wi-Fi is broken. But is it the software? Is it the protocol? Is it the firmware? Is it the hardware? You know.
Yeah. Well, I think the Wi-Fi issue was protocol. So that's more on the sort of math. That's quite curiously really on the mathematical side, I guess. Well, or implementation.
But I would say that the hardware is now all broken. You know, I'm disagreeing for the sake of disagreeing.
Yeah.
With you.
No, I think that the sort of bugs in the processors are genuine cases where the hardware is faulty. And yeah, we still have some faulty hardware, but it's not that bad. But equally, I think if I wanted to counter that, I would say, well, actually, software is mostly pretty good as well. So one of the books that I found really interesting, called The Computer Boys Take Over by Nathan Ensminger. And the one point he's making is that there's ever since the NATO conference, or sort of ever since 50s, there was a perception that software is in some sort of crisis, that there's a crisis and we can't write software. And yet software is really one of the most profitable parts of the economy these days. So there's at least something strange sort of being in the most profitable and most successful area of economy and still feeling like we're in a crisis and everything's going to break down very soon.
Yeah, I noticed that too, and I've been noticing it for a long time, that someone will come along, they'll write a book, they'll create a certification, and they'll say, if you do this, things will be better, with the implication that before this, things sucked. And it's just not the case. We have been writing robust, large systems for a very long time, and we will continue to do so. Now, the TDD movement said, well, it's going to be better. And very, you know, some companies follow it, some companies don't. You take a Netflix, and they have their chaos monkey, and some companies follow it and some don't. But as you say, most companies make relatively okay software that is largely profitable, robust enough for the intention, but doesn't need the excessive engineering that Netflix would do is not needed by most companies. What Amazon does is not needed by most companies. And most companies can't follow that anyway because they don't have the resources for money. They don't have the skills. They don't have the desire. So there is, as you say, there is always a push to say what we've got now is crap. Here's a book. Here's a course. Here's... you know, someone who'll come in and tell you how to do it better.
Yeah, and I think there's sort of you can be very skeptical about it and just say, well, it's people trying to sell books. I think there's sort of genuinely people trying to come up with a proper sort of scientific method for doing software. And this is something that's really, I think, interesting, because everyone sort of feels that you get taught in school that science follows scientific method, where we have a fairly sort of error-free way, or not a fairly sort of good method for acquiring knowledge about the world, and we know in physics how bits of the universe works, and as we spend more and more money on it, we figure out more and more. And in software, there really is no like method for doing it. And I think all these different movements try to come up with a method. So if you go back to the NATO conference, one of their ideas was you have to come up with some method that will make it easy to replace programmers. If someone leaves your company, you hire someone new. The method was all about sort of managing people. And I think TDD, quite curiously, is trying to revert some of this trend and say, well, you really have to trust the people and prefer the people over the method. But in the end, that's a method as well.
Mm-hmm. Right. We've talked quite a bit about the history. There are definitely problems. There are definitely errors in software. But you've studied types as a way of improving correctness. So can you explain that for me? So
yeah,
just to be clear, though, explain types, what you mean by types first, and then how it helps.
Well, so I think that's maybe sort of another method that people come up with. And the context here is the statically typed programming languages, where Haskell is the sort of well-known extreme case, where F-sharp is sort of not that extreme, but a case of this as well. But in general, what I mean by types is, if you're using types in C-sharp, there's a couple of primitive types, then there's classes. If you move to something like F-sharp, it gets more interesting because functions have types. There's things like tuples and records that are built in more interesting structures. If you move to Haskell, then it gets even more crazier because you have types that represent what effects your program has. So if it performs some IO operations, for example, that will be represented in the type. But generally, all these things are trying to catch more errors by having some sort of type checking at compile time that tells you when you do something that's probably wrong, it will tell you this is wrong.
But we have that already. You know, I can't assign something to a something else that's not compatible. And as you say, in my C#, for example, the compiler will catch it. But I imagine you've done more than that with regard to types and correctness.
Yeah. So I think generally what people who sort of follow this religion of types will try to do is to say, well, we need to come up with more types that will capture more about the world. So in C#, you can get an error when you try to pass a dog where a rectangle was expected. In F#, you can get an error when the way you implemented function doesn't match with what you say in the types about it. In Haskell, you can get an error when you try to call a function, and the function would print to the console. What I was working on was types that would track how your program uses some environment in which it runs. So an example would be if you're writing a mobile app, you can access things like GPS and Facebook friends and so on. And the type of the function will tell you this is a function that takes a string and returns a person, and it also needs to access GPS and Facebook friends. And the error might tell you you can't run this function if you don't ask for these permissions from the system.
Okay, so it would be a type as a, is this at a runtime or at a compile time you're suggesting?
At the compile time.
Okay.
So when you build your program, it will tell you this program can only run if you have this, this, and that.
What would be an example, let's say, in a non-mobile app? Let's say I'm building some sort of an enterprise application, has an API, has some other things.
Yeah. So another example that I think that's very different from the previous one, but fits in the same structure of checking your environment. A lot of the financial systems will do some backtesting where you write an algorithm and then to check whether you can predict the markets well, you run it over some history, and at every point you maybe look at the last week of data. And here the environment is, the context is where in the history you need to look. So your type will tell you this is a function that calculates a Boolean, whether you should buy or sell, and it accesses data, and the range is last week. And here it's really useful to know what the range is because, well, partly you can pre-allocate buffers of the right sizes, but also if you accidentally write some code that will predict the market value based on looking into the future, the type will tell you this is a function that looks one day into the future and one week into the history. And you know that that's wrong because you're not allowed to look in the future.
But so if I was doing this in C sharp, I would be able to put rules around, let's say, a model of mine to say, all right, you've given me two dates. One is in the future, one's in the past. That's not acceptable. And you know, specifically, I would use something like a fluent validation library from NuGet. But are you talking about something more comprehensive than that? Because I guess for me, mine would be runtime, whereas you're talking about compile time.
Exactly. So that's the main difference.
But then how would it be configurable? So, you know, let's say you've got one set of rules to examine the history, but then you want to use very similar rules to examine the future, to predict. How would you say, okay, in this type should take both history and future, but in this case, I want to give it to history, and then the next time I run it, I want to give it to future.
So the type, it's all in all this kind of work. You need to have richer language of types. So when you say types, usually in C#, it's just the name of something, of a class or a primitive. With generics, it's a bit more interesting because you can have list of ints and list of strings and so on. And here, the idea is you can take the next step. And rather than having list of strings, you can have history of 5 days. And then your language has to have a clever type system that understands that maybe if you have history of 3 days and for every day you calculate something based on history of 2 days, then you have to add the 2 and 3 together to get 5, because at the very end you're looking sort of 3 into the past and then 2 more into the past.
Are you talking about doing this with languages we already have, like a C#, or are you saying you'd pretty much need a new language to do what you're talking about?
So what I'm talking about, you'd pretty much need a new language. You can encode some of these things in languages that have fancy type systems, like Haskell, for example. So in Haskell, you can actually encode this, but it will be very ugly. So I think for me, the interesting question is, what can we add to the language so that it can do these things, but still remain reasonably nice?
Okay. So let's just say we wanted to stick with C sharp or something. What other ways would you advocate for improving correctness of software or an F sharp, you know, a language that's already in use?
Well, I think one thing that really worked, one thing that I found really sort of different when I started using F sharp more, was that you're very often using the REPL environment. So REPL is the read, eval, print loop. But the idea is that you write a little bit of code and you run it immediately and see the results immediately. So even though F-sharp has a sort of rich type system, I think a lot of the correctness there actually comes from not just from the types, but more from how you interact with it, where when I'm writing some piece of code, I'll sort of start, write the smallest possible thing, test it immediately or run it immediately to see if it does what I think it was supposed to do.
And then if you were looking at, say, the future of software correctness, what do you think is coming in the next few years for us?
So I think what I, well, there's the sort of near future. I think I found this, I find this idea of live coding really interesting. So I have a friend, Sam Aaron, who works on a project called Sonic Pi, where you program, you write some code to program a music synthesizer, and as you're writing your code, you hear the music, or you sort of program and it plays the music. And I think this is really interesting because you get this like really quick feedback. So what I think would be really, really interesting is if we could write software so that as I'm doing something, I immediately get some feedback on what it's going to do. And this is, I think this is something that's happening partly if you look at some editors that are actually able to run code sort of on the side and give you previews. It's something that I think will probably happen a lot in areas like data science, where you're very often writing some code to work with some concrete data. And as you're writing the code, you can see what it will produce when you run it over some data set. So the sort of interactivity and quick feedback, that's something that I think can make it easier for us to write correct code.
Do you see that as a feasible thing, though, with, let's say, again, an enterprise application where I might be calling multiple remote web services, I might be calling a database? You know, this is sort of the, it's very hard to call those things in real time, get the responses, compile them. You know, it feels like this is a serious integration test, but you're talking about doing it live, more or less.
Yeah. So, well, I think if you look at the history, I think this is what people have been doing in, and I don't know the years, but with the Smalltalk programming language, that's again sort of 70s or so when it became available. This is something that sort of annoys me when I read Wikipedia, because if you read the Wikipedia page on Smalltalk, they'll tell you, oh, Smalltalk is a programming language, it has this syntax, and this is how you create objects. But really the point of Smalltalk wasn't in syntax, because their main idea was that programming is about interacting with the system. And the really interesting thing was that your Smalltalk program, when it was running with this whole Smalltalk programming environment sort of built into it. So you had an enterprise application, and people actually use this in banking. and you could connect to it, open your object browser, see what's the state of all the current objects in the system, modify them, and sort of debug on the fly. So I think, and you could, as it was running, you could see what's happening. So I think this is something that people sort of knew how to do some time ago, then we've forgotten how to do it. And I do think we can actually figure out how to do it again. It will probably take sort of changing how we work a bit, but yeah, I think this is definitely, I can imagine it working in a enterprise software as well. But then I'm saying this with my academic hat on. So when I think future, this is more like 10 years is not enough.
I imagine as well, you're not leaving this in isolation. You're still saying we should have our unit tests, our integration tests, our smoke tests, our whatever. This is just one extra little thing to help out.
So I think all these sort of good, useful tools will exist in some way. There's in history of science, there's this idea of paradigm shifts. And paradigm doesn't really mean the same thing as software paradigm. But the idea is that when a sort of radically different way of doing things come, a lot of the ideas we built before, they sort of lose their ground because they no longer, if you switch from functional programming to object-oriented programming, well, this isn't really such a good example, but maybe if you switch from, say, analog computers in the 40s to digital computers in the 60s, you're still sort of programming, but it's changed so much that the things that worked before, some of them don't make any sense in the new one, but some of the things that worked before will find a different use in the new world. So I think even if sort of we'll begin programming in a very different way, there's lots of good stuff that we have that we'll somehow have to reshape and make them usable in a different environment.
Thomas, any final notes before we wrap up for today?
Well, I think I can, we were chatting about the historical and philosophical aspects of what I'm doing. So there's an event that we are organizing with a couple of colleagues called, and this is poor planning because we called it in French and I don't speak French, but it's called Salon de Refusé, which is inspired by this art exhibition that was French for exhibition of rejects. And the idea is to have a space that's sort of somewhere between academic workshop and a conference where people can submit their ideas or presentations of ideas that are a bit more on the fringe. So you wouldn't get them in a usual academic environment. So this is one thing that we can link to. I think that's the sort of main thing on the history and philosophy. The other bit that I would mention is the thing that I'm doing as my sort of main job at the moment, which is a project called The Gamma. And it's, you can find more on thegamma.net. Which is trying to build data visualizations that are more transparent. And the idea is when you see a chart on a website, it shouldn't be just an image, but you should be able to see where the data is coming from, what's been done to it. So if there's anyone interested in data visualizations, they might want to check that out as well.
And then your own website is tomasp.net.
That's correct.
And, well, Tom- Sorry, go ahead,
some
Thomas.
people some people think it's tomasp.net, but that really wasn't the intention, even though I was doing asp.net. And if you dig through the website for long enough, you can find some asp.net articles.
Thomas Petrucek, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
The opening music was a return by Nisi 23 from the album 11 and 12, and the closing music was Bittersweet by Poddington Bear from the album Piano 4 Cinematic.